people after which we ought to be modeling ourselves, for whom celibacy, monasticism are ultimate values. Now, all religious traditions emphasize the fragility of life. And all religious traditions remind us that we can't carry away anything that we own into the grave. And all the religious traditions tend to emphasize the simple truth that the eye is never satisfied with seeing, that the more we sate and satisfy our appetites, the more we want. And so many of the traditions have come to emphasize want not, seek not, be not engaged in life. Rather, pull back, withdraw. Be indifferent to all those things you think are most consequential. For you will not find happiness or peace by seeking to control or to conquer or to have. For you'll never be satisfied. You're simply asking for frustration. Now, our tradition has never glorified the monk or the saint in the sense that we have made them into the paradigms of the religious heroes whom we ought to, in our best mode, to be attempting to emulate. Our tradition tells us to be out and to be among. Hillel's basic maxim, which set the tone for the entire rabbinic tradition, was separate not yourself from the community. Be involved, be engaged. And yet at the same time, our tradition recognizes that this question that Ecclesiastes asked is a valid question. What profit hath man from all his labors wherein he labors under the sun? What ultimately is the value of all that we care so much about, or say we care so much about? What are we trying to accomplish with all this frenetic energy which we dispense in being goal-oriented people? There are lessons which the mystic and the saint can teach us. Lessons which come to us only when you turn off the sensory apparatus. When you turn off the world which we call the real world, the world in which we gain experience, the world in which we try to manage our lives, and withdraw. And listen not to the noises and voices of the world, but to the voice within. And turn with the inner eye to seek the truth that comes through meditation and through that kind of understanding. And so, since this is the shape in which Yom Kippur is designed, I would like this evening to spend with you a little time with one of the great venerable saints and mystics of our tradition, to speak with you of a subject which concerned him greatly, a surprising subject, and one which we might well contemplate throughout this holy day. Many of you have visited Israel. And in Israel, you went, in all probability, to the city of Tzfat, to that little mountaintop town in the Lower Galilee, which in the 16th and 17th century was the center of a great mystical circle were some of the great heroes of that kind of religious interest among our people congregated, a rather remarkable group of men. And none was more remarkable, none more venerated by our people, but a man who died there at a young age of 38 in 1572, a man who was given the name of Isaac ben Solomon Luria when he was born, but who was known throughout the Jewish world for centuries after his life by the name of Ha'ari, which is an acronym for Elohi Rabbi Yitzhak, the divine Rabbi Isaac. Let me tell you very briefly what little we know about his life. He was born in Jerusalem. His father was from Ashkenazic background. His mother was a Sephardi. At the age of 7 or 8, he was orphaned, and he was sent to an uncle in Cairo, where he was given the usual Talmudic education of a youngster of that day, apprenticed to the family business, and married at the usual age in those days of 15. Now, if there is any practical advice to be gained from the life of this saint, it is simply this: that if you have a family business, never engage the saint to be in the business. Because the saint deals with supernal and supernatural ideas, not with the commonplace practical ideas of every day. He was a disaster in the family business. But somehow or other, when he was in his late teens, he came across a copy of the Zohar, the great mystical commentary on the Torah and the five books of Moses, which was actually compiled in Spain in the 13th century, but which he and the men of his generation believed to have been written 1,000 years earlier under inspiration by the great mystic Rabbi Simeon Bar Yochai. And Ari was fascinated by this book of speculation, of a theosophy, of metaphysics, in which largely the theme is, what is the nature of God? What's God like? What can we say about God? What does God's world really correspond to? How can we understand it? What's the real world, God's world, all about? And he sought out teachers, and he learned from them as much of the metaphysics and the philosophic system underlying the Kabbalah as he could. And then in his early 20s, we're told, he went out and built a little shed on the side of the Nile River, and he withdrew from his life and spent several years in meditation and contemplation there on the banks of the Nile. And as is the way with the mystics in their moments of contemplation, he began to feel that he was hearing the voices of ancient figures. Elijah specifically spoke to him and told him a great deal about the mysteries of the universe. And he had the sensation at times that his soul left the body and mounted to the heavens, and there he could speak with the patriarchs, with the other great figures of the past, who taught him more about the messianic coming, about the nature of life, and the nature of what they knew of the nature of God. And in all of this, he gained quite a reputation as a holy man, as a healer. And during this period, he gained a reputation of being able to look a person in the eye and to see the sadness in a person's soul and to be able to prescribe the remedy for that sadness. We know very little, really, about the life of the Ari, except we know that when he was 35, Elijah told him that it was time for him to go to Sfat, to surround himself there with the mystic circle of people who lived there, to teach what he had learned, because he was going to die young. And he went to Sfat, and 3 years later he died, we believe a victim of the Black Plague, which was then decimating Europe and Asia. Now, mystics are concerned with questions which are not the normal run of the questions which are at the front of our minds. We think largely, when we think of matters religious in the first instance, as to what we need of God. We pray to God for health, for the well-being of our family. We pray that God will somehow keep this troubled world of ours in one piece so that our children and our grandchildren will have a future. We think of what we need from God and sometimes of what God requires of us in terms of a return for the gift of life. We think of the responsibilities and duties which God imposes upon us. Another question preoccupied the RE. Do we need from God, but what does God need from us? And that's a strange question. Because if God has any definition, that definition involves omnipotence and omniscience. God is all-knowing, God is all-powerful. That's as far as anyone has it, the definition of God. How can a being that is all-powerful need us? And yet somehow in his imagination and his meditations, the Ari came to the conclusion that God needs us. How did he come to this conclusion? When mystics, who think very differently than we do, concentrate, what do they concentrate on? They concentrate on the nature of God. Now we simply say, really, God's a mystery. We can't really understand what God is really like. But the mystic wants to know more. He's not satisfied with that. And when he tries to understand God, he tends to concentrate on the one moment in time when God most intruded upon the world that of which we are a part, the world which we know, the time of creation. For according to the mystics, it is at creation that God somehow, through his spirit, through the energy which is within him, through the divine light, reaches out into the universe and becomes part of the universe. And so, if we could only understand that process and reverse it, and come back up the ladder towards God, the ladder of creation, the mystic believes he will be able to understand something of God's nature. Now, the mystics of all the great medieval traditions, Muslim, Christian, and Jewish, tended to describe creation in terms of a theory which they called emanation. It's an old Greek theory. It's the idea that at creation, God allows something of his nature. The metaphor they usually used was light. Something of the divine light to spread out further and further into the universe, to flood out and to flow out from him into the void. And as that light grew further and further away from the Godhead, it became more and more enmeshed in the primal matter and became the kind of physical world of which we are, in fact, conscious. Now, that concept is very old, was generally accepted in the Kabbalistic circles of which the Ari was a part. But somehow during his meditations, the Ari heard or came to understand in ways which defy common sense and defy reason, which had nothing to do with science or experimentation or logic. He came to understand that that was not quite the way creation had come about. Yes, there had been the emanation of the divine light, and yes, it had begun to stream forth and to flow forth from God into creation. But then during the ultimate act of creation, a terrible accident had taken place, the Ari discovered. And that is that some of the channels through which the divine light was flowing down into the world could not contain the power of that light, and they split open. And a good bit of the light of God was scattered hither and yon into the universe, and caught out there in the darkness where it remains. Which is to say that that which is God is no longer a unity. Something of God was lost out there during creation. Now you say that's a bizarre idea. Why think about it? Why should the rabbi at Yom Kippur of all things bother me with a story that's of this kind? But I would like to suggest to you this evening that not only does this story contain lessons worth listening to, but it was this image of the accident which occurred at creation, which allowed the Jews of the Ari's generation and many generations thereafter to survive. It gave them strangely an understanding, a vision of life, which gave their lives at a very difficult time grace and meaning. Now, what do I mean? The Ari's generation was not unlike our own. And by that I mean that he lived 40, 50 years after one of the great catastrophes of Jewish history. We live 40, 50 years after the Holocaust. He lived half a century after the destruction, the final destruction of the Jewry of the Spanish kingdom. A 1,000-year-old Jewry in his day, the greatest cultural center of Jewish life, the most populous center of Jewish life for many centuries, a life which had suddenly been ended in 1492 when the Spanish king and queen, Ferdinand and Isabella, had ordered summarily all the Jews of the kingdom to be exiled within a 3-month period. This great community was suddenly wiped out. They had only two alternatives, to convert or to leave, and there was no place to go. And we're told by the historians that perhaps several hundred thousand of them lost their lives in a desperate attempt to find a place of refuge here or there. And then during the intervening decades, as you'll remember from your history, they, like we, had prisoners of conscience. Men and women who had tried to remain in Spain by feigning conversion, the Muranos, who, attempting to save their lives, to save what possessions they had, had accepted a nominal baptism, but had found that they had exchanged one disaster for another, because they had given themselves over to the not-so-tender mercies of the Catholic Inquisition, the torture chambers, and ultimately, if they were found to be recidivists, they were burnt at the stakes at the auto-da-fes. And again in these communities, in Jerusalem, Sfat, Cairo, elsewhere, these prisoners of conscience who had somehow escaped would show up and would tell the people of the Siberia, of the psychiatric institutions from which they had fled, of the terrors which they had known back at home. And so that generation, like ours, was burdened with a terrible question. Why had God not intervened? Why did not God save his Jews, his people, these innocents? Why did he allow this torture, this disaster to take place? Now, the question in our generation has been to a degree assuaged for us by the simple fact of the creation of the State of Israel. We came to feel somehow that the phoenix rose from the ashes, that all was not lost. But there was no such event to lighten the shadows, the darkness of the Ariz generation. Wherever Jews lived, they lived in exile, they lived in the diaspora, they lived under the control of others, unsufferance and tolerance, not knowing whether the next day or the next they might be summarily exiled, their property expropriated, their lives taken. So the question they faced was the simple, basic question. Why had God not intervened? And you remember, after the Second World War, there were a number of theologians who began to speak of what they called the death of God, by which they meant that there was a God, and the God was a creator God, but he was indifferent, essentially. He had allowed the world to go on its own way. He simply was not related to what was happening here on earth. The Ari had another answer. The Ari's answer was that God had not intervened because God could not intervene. That's a strange thought, and a very disappointing one. But what did he mean? In that vision, remember, of the accident of creation, where the part of the light of God, the nature of God, had been lost out there in the darkness, God was no longer all he had been at creation. He was unable to bring about Israel's redemption. That seems like a hopeless doctrine, beyond being a bizarre and strange one. But the Ari had heard another part of this strange mystical teaching. He had heard the truth that the mitzvot, the pieties, the devotions, the good deeds of the Jews had infinite power, that they had a ripple effect, that a good deed's power was never lost, and that it not only affected the person or the here and now, but it reached out into the universe. And it had the power to break open the shells which enclosed out there that piece of God which was somehow lost, free the spark to be reunited with God himself. And so to this generation of victims who might well have thought of themselves as the flotsam of the universe, caught on an ocean, bouncing here and there without any control, the Ari brought a message of purpose and of hope. Israel is not insignificant, for the deeds of Israel, the mitzvot, obeying the commandments of God, are the ultimate way through which redemption will come to the world, because in measure as Israel performs its duty, its devotions, its pieties, it will free God to become himself, and when God is holy himself, redemption will be assured. A strange idea? Surely. A mystical idea? Certainly. An idea which is logical? Reasonable? Not at all. But psychologically, spiritually, emotionally, it was a redemptive idea to that generation. May we call these acts of devotion and of piety and of obeying the mitzvot, the duties which are incumbent upon all of us, he called that tikkun, which is a Hebrew word which comes from a root which means to repair, to make whole. Tikkun is a reparation. And if we were to translate this doctrine of tikkun into our own ordinary everyday language, we would say simply this: Ultimately, the fate of the world depends upon us. Ultimately, what we do, how we live, the causes we serve, the contributions we make to our community, the involvement and the energy and the mind and the intellect and the good sense and the wisdom we bring to our larger concerns, these ultimately will determine whether our world survives or not. But interestingly, if you look at our world, this strange, turbulent, wonderful, terrible world in which we live, one of the most striking features of the last several centuries is the fact that there have been innumerable successful movements of liberation. People liberating themselves from colonial and imperialistic rule, people seeking to liberate themselves from the privilege of certain classes, from the power of those who had feudal authority or who had control of government. But in so many cases, these great movements of liberation, which were meant to bring opportunity and amplitude and decency and grace to human life, have ended in our century in a tyranny as great, if not greater, than that which they overthrew. The Gulag is, after all, the creation of those who overthrew Tsarist rule. And wherever we turn in our world, we can find example after example of a movement designed to free a people, which, when it was successful, found the leaders of the revolution imprisoning their own people. Why so? The Ari, who is not a social thinker or a social activist, but a saint, suggests in his mystical vision an answer. He suggests that no one can save the world, perform an act of tikkun, until their own spirits are whole, until the spark of the divine within them is allowed to flame up and to become the controlling element within their personality. He had a second part to this strange story of his about the accident which occurred at creation. The mystics believed that whatever happened on earth, in the heavens, had a counterpart here on earth. And so that just as there had been an accident in the creation of the cosmos, so there was an accident in the creation of man. When Adam was created, according to the mystics, Adam bore within him the souls, the spirit, if you will, of all future beings, you and I, everyone else, everyone who would ever live upon this earth. We might call it a genetic reservoir. But Adam had sinned, and that was the accident. And when Adam sinned, all of these souls, these spirits, the purity which was intended for all of us, spilled out into the world and became imprisoned in material life, in the body, and needed to be repaired. That which had been whole was in shreds. It needed to be made whole again. How does one become whole again? Through tikkun, through acts of reparation. And here the mystics and the Ari spoke of a specific kind of reparation. They spoke of the kind of reparation that they engaged in with their disciples. That is, they spent time, they listened to, they looked carefully at, they were sensitive, empathetic, compassionate, and so they were able to understand the essence, the spirit, the sadness, the sorrow, the sickness in another soul, and somehow deal with it. And so when the Ari spoke of tikkun in terms of human relationships, he spoke of taking time, of one-on-one relationships, of the parent who loves and encourages and teaches and provides an example to and is always supportive of the child, of the husband, of the wife, who is responsive to, sensitive to, patient with, at all times, the needs of the other, of the friend who is willing to take time from the busyness of life to listen with the inner ear, to listen patiently until the whole need of the another has been exposed and expressed, and then to respond sensitively wisely and intelligently. That's tikkun, the one-on-one reparation of the soul. And how many go out to save the world, but are not willing to save a single life? But how does one get to the point of being able to perform tikkun, to be sensitive enough, or wise enough, or patient enough to be able to listen attentively to another? How does one become what the Indians would call a mahatma, a great soul, whose spirit is able, in fact, to perform these acts of cosmic tikkun, which will redeem the world? And this is the final element in this strange mystical insight of the Ari, which came to him not through logic and not through reason or common sense, but through the voice from the supernatural world. He said, in measure as you give, so you receive. In measure as you share, so it is shared with you. That is, it is by performing the act itself that you light and encourage and develop the spirit, the divinity which is within you. The potential is there. And it is unlocked not only by another, through counseling, through love, through compassion and empathy, but it is unlocked by the very act of sharing, by the very act in which you empathize and are compassionate, the very time that you spend with another. It is in the doing that you open and free and purify your own soul. And to the saint, only those whose souls have been purified ought ever to be entrusted with the saving of the world. Because otherwise, those who save the world have all of the normal armory of ambitions and greeds and ego needs and needs for prestige and power and indifference to the concerns of others which afflict the children of men. And however noble their ideals, along the way, they become callous to a degree, they become concerned only with accomplishment. They lack the soul which allows them to truly bring the ultimate redemption, the tikkun, which our world so desperately needs. The saint and the mystic is not a writer. The Ari left very little by way of literature, few mystical hymns about the Sabbath. His powers and his charisma, and the power of the myth which he speaks, and the power of his person in his relationships with another. But he said one thing which is perhaps is worth pondering throughout this Yom Kippur, as we think of tikkun, which is obviously one of the great themes of Yom Kippur. How does God need us? He said, you know, it's surprising. So many people spend so much time and energy trying to pierce the veil which separates the next world from this world. And yet they live side by side all of their lives with others, and there's a veil between them, and never really try to pierce that veil. This Yom Kippur, let's try to pierce the veil which separates us from another. And let's think of tikkun in the most intimate sense in which the Ari spoke of the term. It's our obligation to spend time with, to be sensitive to help, to heal, to listen, to encourage, to love, to save, and in saving another, to save ourselves. Amen.